Let's get started. Thanks for having me out. This is my first year here, so thank you to Dr. Levy as well for kind of handing me a talk topic and title. That's like the hardest part of putting together a talk is figuring out what to talk about. So I'm an emergency medicine physician and medical toxicologist at the University of Kansas Medical Center. Marijuana legalization is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart as someone from Portland, where I would describe our marijuana culture as aggressive. So financial disclosures, sadly, for yet another year, I have none, but I'm still in fellowship mode, so I'm very open to them, if anyone's listening. These are my objectives, so we're going to review a brief kind of history of cannabis, discuss routes of use and some physiological effects, and then review issues kind of surrounding legalization. And this is sort of a semi-emergency medicine talk. A lot of this just in the sense that emergency medicine crosses over a lot with, you know, social issues, social justice, and so does cannabis in a lot of senses. So the term cannabinoid refers to any compound, whether endogenous or exogenous, that binds to cannabinoid receptors. So while the term cannabis specifically refers to the bioactive substances coming from plants, of which there are over 100, the term cannabinoid can really be a lot of different things, from endogenous cannabinoids made by the body, plant materials, and then a lot of synthetics are out there. So as far as cannabis goes, kind of the major compounds we talk about are cannabinol to a lesser degree, but cannabidiol very much so, and tetrahydrocannabinol, which is THC. So no tox topic or no tox talk is complete without some chemical structure. So we'll get that out of the way early, and I promise we won't go back to it. But this is an example of sort of the breadth of structural variability of cannabinoids. So there's endogenous cannabinoids up at the top there, and I know that's a little bit hard to see, but they're compounds that resemble things that we already kind of think about in the body. So arachidonic acid, which is involved in the inflammatory cascade. And then we've got synthetics like these JWH compounds kind of in the middle here. These were the things that were found in K2 and Spice. Those got really popular kind of in the 2000s, caused a lot of people to go to the ICU and rhabdo, hyperthermic, things like that. They were actually created by a chemist who was trying to, they're named JWH after John William Huffman. He was the chemist that created them. And, he was looking to research cannabinoids and realized he made a huge mistake when the things that he synthesized were found in these products over like in Europe. So I think he's kind of regretted the decision to make those in the first place, but he was not trying to make something harmful. Then there's phytocannabinoids, which are kind of the things we get out of plants if you were to smoke marijuana. And then at the bottom, there's these sort of relatively newer things, the indole and indazole synthetic cannabinoids, AB fubinaca, which was developed by Pfizer, never made it to the market, but has been seen in a lot of kind of street products. As far as pharmacology goes, so there's, we think of it as kind of two receptors. There's a CB1 receptor and the CB2 receptor. These are both cannabinoid receptors. It was kind of originally described as, central CNS CB1 receptors and peripheral CB2 receptors, although research is kind of pointing to the idea that CB2 receptors might also exist in the CNS. But what should speak really to the complexity of the endocannabinoid system, as well as the varied effects that cannabinoids have, is that cannabinoid receptors are actually the most numerous G-protein-coupled receptors in the mammalian brain. And there are a lot of these different types of receptors, but of the G-protein-coupled receptors, cannabinoid receptors are the most common. So they do a lot of things. As far as metabolism goes, after smoking, like smoking anything, serum concentrations peak very, very quickly. That's why people smoke things. And then it starts to get metabolized. You see, after the initial peak in THC, you actually get metabolism to hydroxy-THC, which is an active compound, and then subsequently to an inactive compound called carboxy-THC, which takes kind of a much slower and longer path. The ingestion of marijuana takes a little bit longer, as you would expect. The ingestion, it takes a while to absorb, but follows kind of a similar path. So how is marijuana used? I like to do this set of slides just to get everyone up to speed on how many different faces that marijuana can have or cannabis can have. And so, you know, there's people in the audience that are probably going to be like, yep, done that, done that, done that. And then there's other people who are going to be like, I don't even know what a marijuana looks like. So I just want to bring everyone up to speed. So this is kind of the OG, like the original way to do this, which is, you know, it's the flower. So this is smoked out of a joint, a pipe, or a bong. There are a bunch of different strains. So if you went to, say, if you went over to Colorado right now and went into one of these weed shops, they'd pull out a literal menu. I mean, pages and pages of menus with all of these strains, all of the CBD and THC concentrations on them. So a ton of different strains out there. So for comparison, you know, your 1960s marijuana, like your dad's marijuana, was probably 2 to 3% THC. And now we're seeing things in the stores that are 25, 30%, 35% THC. So we have come a long way as far as potency of marijuana goes. Edibles are another commonly consumed cannabis product. So these used to be kind of homemade, super variable from batch to batch and maybe even like brownie to brownie. You know, people didn't know the concentration of the strain they were working with. They didn't know how good their extraction was. They didn't know how good, you know, they were able to mix it in. So, you know, you could really get some variability. Now with the commercially produced products, they're a little more consistent. There have been studies that looked at how kind of inconsistent these were compared to what was labeled on the package. And there are inconsistencies, but not nearly as much as like a homemade product. Colorado, as a matter of fact, actually has what's called threshold testing. So they basically, if a package says there's 100 milligrams in this bag, they do a threshold test as a kind of a QI measure to make sure that the number of milligrams of THC cannot exceed 100 in the package if that's what it's labeled as, and if it does, it's pulled off the shelf. So there are some kind of QI measures. Ultimately, the biggest issue with edible marijuana is dose stacking, which kind of comes from the lag time between onset of symptoms and when you ate it. This is actually a really interesting, I won't read the article to you, but if you were interested in looking this up, this is a New York Times writer who went to Colorado after they legalized recreational cannabis and basically didn't know what she was doing, was like, ate an edible and then was like, this didn't do anything, so she ate more, and then she like spent the entire night like laying on the bed paralyzed, crying and like vomiting. It's actually a hilarious account. So this is hash or hashish. So this is like purified resin. This is kind of the original concentrated product. This can be smoked in a pipe typically, but it also can be eaten. This is kind of a newer product. So this is called dabbing. These are, you basically use kind of either of these. The top is what we call wax, which is, I mean, it's named after what it looks like. So that's wax. The bottom they typically refer to as shatter. These are really, really heavily concentrated THC products, and this is what's called the dab setup. So there's a nail, they call it a nail, it's like a glass nail. You heat it up, you take a like a dipper thing, grab some of your wax, and then touch it to the hot nail, and that creates the plume of smoke in that area, and then you suck it through like a bong. So these are really, really concentrated, 80 to 90 plus percent THC. So really, these are like crazy, crazy concentrated. People did try, those are now commercially produced, but people still try to make these at home. This has been an issue for a while. This is called butane hash oil. So what they're doing in this GIF is basically they're forcing butane, which is a solvent, through a pipe containing flowered marijuana, and that extracts the THC into a bunch of butane at the bottom. So then they put it on a stove, genius, to try and distill it off. And of course, this is the kind of common, this has happened everywhere. I mean, this continues to happen to this day despite some of the products being available in stores. So certainly some hazardous things. As far as historical context, cannabis has been around for literally thousands of years. It has been mentioned in many texts. It has been used in many societies all over the world, dates back thousands of years. It's mentioned in the Vedas, these ancient religious texts from South Asia, and has been used there religiously for quite some time. So this has been, I mean, cannabis is obviously a very, very old product, and it's been known for quite some time. Western society has taken some time to come around to the idea of cannabis, especially as like a medicinal product. In the 1800s, an Irish physician by the name of William O'Shaughnessy goes to India and starts kind of working with cannabis and researching it for different ailments, brings it back to Europe, and starts to incorporate it into Western medicine. So in the U.S., cannabis is used as a substance of abuse from kind of the 1850s all the way up to the 1930s. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics in the U.S. starts to portray marijuana as this sort of powerful, addictive substance. In the late 1930s, the movie Tell Your Children, which was later renamed to the famous Reefer Madness, was financed by a church group to portray all of the like terrible things that could happen to you if you partook in the devil's lettuce. So despite that, all of the, just kind of despite all the bad press, marijuana was listed in the U.S. Pharmacopoeia from 1850 to 1942. But in 1970, the Controlled Substances Act classifies marijuana as a Schedule I drug. So, you know, as you probably know, this is like the highest classification of illegality. So Schedule I drug substances or chemicals are defined as drugs with no currently accepted medical use and high potential for abuse. So some things that it's classified with are, you know, lysergic acid, you know, methylene dioxymethamphetamine or MDMA, Quaaludes, and like peyote. So that's kind of the class that we're looking at for Schedule I drugs. So we move into the 80s, and with that comes the kind of Nancy Reagan era and Just Say No, and of course the kind of the famed war on drugs, which is going great. The DARE program, you know, starts to enter schools and teach kids how terrible drugs are, you know, and that they need to stay away from them at all costs and they'll ruin their lives. And then, you know, we get all these kind of, this is like the phrase that I grew up with was, this is your brain on drugs. We get all these PSAs that are telling us that abstinence is the key. And so the U.S. gets very tough on drugs, and marijuana is a prime target. So throughout the 90s and 2000s, a steady increase in the proportion of arrests that are made from marijuana. Simultaneously, the absolute number of marijuana possession arrests grows. And between 2001 and 2010, police made more than 8.2 million marijuana arrests across the U.S., so quite a lot. You know, of note, it's been demonstrated just over and over and over again, you know, in state after state, that there are stark differences in arrest rates depending on race. So in a very real sense, the argument for decriminalization and legalization is and can be considered a kind of a social justice argument. The estimated fiscal cost, if social justice isn't for you, is staggering. I mean, you know, marijuana enforcement cost in 2010, for the middle estimate here, is $3.6 billion. So police and legal expenditures can constitute kind of the bulk of the fiscal cost of marijuana possession enforcement. New York, for example, spent $575 million in a year on you know, police and judicial services. California in that same period spent $425 million. So that's $1 billion between just those two states alone. So using kind of the middle estimate, you can calculate police spent around $4,390 per arrest. And for a prosecute for a full felony conviction, almost $75,000 per case. And that doesn't really take into account the cost to the individual. So there's a lot of hidden costs with this, you know, legal defense costs and things like that. So if you go out and try and see how much it costs, there's I came across the LegalMatch.com. It's a website that basically helps people, you know, find defense lawyers. And they said hiring a criminal defense lawyer for a marijuana case can cost between $10,000 and $15,000. So that is a lot of cash up front for most of these people. So finally, I would be remiss if I neglected to talk about this sort of DARE and say no to drugs and how this impacts your kids. I don't myself have kids, but I put this under hidden cost because I am told that there's pros to having children. They're cute. They're fun to hang out with. Family vacations. You can watch them grow. But when you expose them to DARE officers in school telling them how evil pot is, things start to change. They will narc on you. So, this is a kid that turns his parents in for pot at his school. Isolated case, think again. Another girl. Another one. Another one. I mean, you can find these all over the place. So, it seems to be that kind of like 9 to 12 age group, so you really got to watch out for them. So, I want to take some time to explore legalization, as well as the benefits and kind of concerns to society. So this graphic demonstrates the kind of legalization at various levels, state by state. So after a lot of kind of harsh marijuana enforcement, I think people were starting to come around to the idea that, like, maybe it's not that bad, and it's really expensive to enforce, and, like, we could actually get a lot of tax money from this. So, you know, simultaneously through much of the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of states were enacting laws that that allowed for the medical use of cannabis for select conditions. So on the upside, this decreases the amount of people who can be arrested for possession. On the downside, you've got, like, this guy giving medical advice to your grandma about her glaucoma and whether or not, you know, Purple Kush or Sour Diesel is the right strain. So it gets very pseudoscience-y very quick. So I'm a little, it can, you know, pluses and minuses. But so as of 2020, you know, this is the status of marijuana legalization in every state in the union. So I think there's been a few additions since this graphic has been made. But despite that, you know, it kind of doesn't really matter whether it's legal or not. If you talk to the DEA puts out a report every year that details kind of the state of every kind of illegal drug that you can think of. All but four DEA divisions in the U.S. report marijuana availability as high, meaning cannabis is available and readily obtainable at any time. The rest of the four divisions, which if you're wondering, were Atlanta, the Caribbean, El Paso, and New Jersey, reported moderate availability. So that means that it's generally readily accessible. So to me, this kind of says it doesn't really matter what your laws are, whether you're just medical, whether you're recreational, whether you're completely illegal. People are going to be able to smoke marijuana no matter what. They are going to have access to it if they want. Now, as we briefly mentioned before, there's financial benefits to full legalization largely, and that comes in the form of tax revenue. So in 2021, the state of Colorado collected $423 million in tax revenue. And since legalization, as of January 2022, they have collected over $2 billion in tax revenue. So this is, I feel like, what they're probably feeling. So there, of course, are concerns over, you know, kind of unleashing marijuana. You know, there's legitimate concerns. So will this increase, you know, use in our vulnerable populations? You know, teenagers, younger kids. You know, what will legalization mean for our hospital system? Are we going to see a bunch of people come in with hyperemesis or car accidents or, you know, overdoses? You know, am I going to get killed by a stoned driver out there? You know, is everyone just going to be driving stoned? And kind of what are the long-term effects? What are we going to be dealing with in, say, 40 years? So, and then there's also this kind of talk of psychiatric effects. So are we going to create a bunch of, like, psychotic patients running around? So these are there are a lot of questions out there. These are just kind of some of them. You could think about this all day and come up with more. But the answer for a lot of these, honestly, is that we really don't quite know yet. So there is some data we can look to kind of tell us. This is data from the National Institute of Drug Abuse concerning kind of teenage use. They basically have been doing this survey. It's called the Monitoring the Future Survey in middle schools and high schools. They've been doing this since 1975 and just asking people about their use, their drug use. These surveys generally have not found a difference in adolescent use of cannabis kind of before and after medical marijuana laws, so after sort of more liberalization. Medical marijuana states tended to have higher adolescent use overall than non-medical marijuana states, which isn't surprising. You know, if you think about the states that legalized medical marijuana first, these are the states where people, you know, were pretty readily smoking weed. But it doesn't seem like that medical marijuana laws actually increase adolescent use. So what's this going to look like in the next 10 years, and kind of how do we factor in recreational laws? We probably don't really know yet. Hospital visit data. So, the two major things we typically see in the ED or that I get consulted on are hyperemesis and, you know, mostly a lot of small kids who accidentally ingest edibles because peanut butter cups look delicious, no matter what's in them. So here's an example of a study using before and after data in Colorado comparing hyperemesis visits. They found visits to the emergency department almost doubled, implying one of two things. So either more people are having hyperemesis, which is totally plausible, or the people who are vomiting are just more willing to say, I was smoking weed, because now it's more accepted, and now, you know, now they're willing to kind of fess up to it. We don't know. So this is a study looking at, data from U.S. Poison Control Centers, looking at the call volume increase related to pediatric exposure. So, you know, are more kids just, like, eating these things by accident? They found no increase in states that did not legalize, but actually had a 30% annual increase in calls from states or cannabis with cannabis decriminalization laws. So, you know, again, it's hard to interpret what that means. Is it that there are more exposures, which again is completely plausible, or is it that parents are willing to call and be like, "Hey, my kid ingested marijuana," since they're legal and they have sort of a fallback and aren't going to get put in prison? So. Cannabis and driving, a couple of questions. How big is the problem? How prevalent is driving under the influence of cannabis? What is the level of impairment? So is it the same as if you're intoxicated on alcohol? And does legalization contribute to an increase in driving under the influence? So in contrast to ethanol users who consistently underestimate their level of impairment, users of THC in driving simulators overestimate their level of impairment and tend to drive really slow even when the person doing the simulation is telling them to drive faster. So, you know, are you a better driver? No, but the question is, are you as bad as if you're on, you know, drinking alcohol? So it's unclear. So studies are all over the board as far as traffic accidents. So some studies demonstrate that medical marijuana actually result in a decrease in traffic fatalities people with a blood alcohol concentration greater than 0.08, so maybe they're shifting from drinking alcohol to smoking weed. Some studies demonstrate a difference in fatalities with recreational cannabis laws, but not medical cannabis laws in certain age groups. Some studies demonstrate a clear increase in fatalities in one state, but not another state with recreational. So they're kind of all over the board, and I think it's probably too early to really make a judgment about what the impact on traffic is going to be. So other public health concerns, you know, obviously mental health concerns come up. I think the question, you know, is what impact does unleashing marijuana on the public really have in the long term as far as our mental health? Again, the answer is a little bit unclear. So this is a multi-center case control study from Europe, and they concluded there is, in fact, an association between daily cannabis use and psychotic disorder. Now, that is just an association. They found that cannabis daily use was associated with an odds ratio of 3.2 of getting a psychotic disorder over never users. And this increased with higher potency. So, you know, certainly something to look at. Is it riskier to be using higher potency, like the butane hash oils and things like that? The odds ratio for high potency was 4.8 versus 3.2 for just the daily kind of low potency users. So again, you know, it's important to remember that these are just associations. We can't determine causation from this study alone, but certainly something that we need to be concerned about. And then, of course, you know, there's physiological effects. You know, if people are going to be smoking things, if you're a daily smoker of anything and you're inhaling that smoke, you know, you're pyrolyzing and inhaling cannabis products, we know that these produce similar effects to tobacco when used habitually. But there seems to be significantly reduced risk, not surprisingly, for people who are just occasional users. So if you're an occasional user, you probably have nothing to worry about. If you're a daily user, you certainly are at risk for some of these lung diseases. So as far as conclusions, you know, cannabis is really, really difficult and expensive to enforce. We spend a lot of money on it. It costs a lot, not just to taxpayers, but to people who have to defend these cases. You know, citizens of states without legalization already have access to cannabis. I mean, you can get it anywhere, no matter where you live and what your laws are. A lot of these people just have to cross state lines. You know, legalization provides a path for states to raise enormous amounts of funds that could potentially be put to good use. You know, we obviously need further research to kind of look down the road at some of the health effects, but you know, you're going to have a trade-off no matter what you do, and we spend a lot of money on this. So my conclusion is, you know, I think we need to legalize. So I am happy to take questions. Yes?
Hilarious talk. Great job. Funny.
Thanks.
Obviously, there was a study in New England Journal just a few weeks ago showing how cannabis legalization in Canada is, again, it's association, like you said,
sure,
massively profound. Again, in New England, I recommend you look at that study.
Sure.
It's pretty impressive. Parallel study in American Journal of Public Health from June of last year showing the same thing in Colorado. So the associations are overwhelmingly statistically strong on the driving impairment and not making you a better driver.
Yes, agreed. Agreed. Under no circumstances do I think you are a better driver.
Associations. In addition, there's a couple of birth cohort studies from Australia, Australasia, that show early cannabis initiation. initiation does indeed predict mental health problems.
Sure. Yep.
Again, these are very strongly statistically sound studies that, yeah, they're not RCTs,
right.
But they're pretty impressive. It's sort of like tobacco. You know, we don't have any RCTs for tobacco either. And I'm not going to argue that the alcohol, you know, alcohol is horrible too, even worse, but the data are definitely coming in that it's really not such a great thing.
Yeah, I think as you see more and more states legalize, I mean, a lot of these studies are based on early years in Colorado, you know, early years in Oregon and Washington. So I think as we keep going, we're gonna be able to figure out this answer pretty quickly. And it sounds like we may be coming to that point. Yes. Yeah.
Packaging is really well done, and I've actually only seen one patient because I thought I would see a lot more, but she got her older brother's edibles. What's the management for those type of kids?
Yeah, so kids much more so than adults. Adults almost, and it's almost always edibles because of just, they look so delicious to kids. I mean, we see these all the time in our children's hospital. I have only once had to intubate an adult for cannabis use, but kids actually get intubated for this relatively frequently. It's really just supportive care. You want to, they can lose their airway reflexes much faster than an adult can. So it's really just putting them in the ICU, monitoring them, and letting them metabolize. But it really can, we've seen these take like days to metabolize, so. Yep, thanks.